Neil Kashkari wishes more people were paying attention to California. Republicans hate that they have to pay attention to Kansas. And, yes, friends, the As the World Turns soap opera comes to an end in Virginia. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president,
add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 42 of The Political Junkie. September means the start of fall, crisp air, football season, and debates. The two candidates for governor of California squared off last week in their first and only encounter before the November election. We'll talk about whether it changed the dynamics of the race and what California voters care about. Kansas held its first debates this weekend with a pretty rowdy crowd.
Come on, folks. Settle down.
And what are we doing, talking about a Kansas Senate race? Well, suddenly the Sunflower State has put a completely unexpected wrinkle into the GOP's plans for winning a majority in the Senate. Let's note for the record that Republican Senate candidates in Kansas have won every contest since 1933. And there's no debate in Virginia. Everyone seems to agree that the guilty verdicts against former Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife were justified. But many are still grimacing over the tactics used by the defense. And finally, we do a heck of a job in our This Week in Political History feature. But first, the trivia question. Among the states that held primaries on Tuesday was New Hampshire. With all the focus on women in politics, New Hampshire holds one record. It's the only state to have its governor, both senators, and every U.S. House member represented by women. But let's make the trivia a little more difficult. What's the first state to have a woman as its governor as well as one of its senators at the same time? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stick around. Once, the highlight of the midterm elections was for governor of California. Think Pat Brown versus Richard Nixon in 1962, or Ronald Reagan versus Pat Brown 4 years later. Those Jerry Brown victories in the 70s, or Pete Wilson taking on those illegal immigrants. And let's not forget the governator just a few years ago. Now, sadly, it's hard to get excited about who will be leading the Golden State for the next 4 years, at least as far as the election goes. Polls show Governor Jerry Brown with a huge lead over his Republican opponent, Neil Kashkari, a former U.S. Treasury Department official in the Bush administration. Jerry Brown is always good copy. 4 decades in the public eye can do that. Last week, the two squared off for their first and probably only debate of the campaign. KQED's John Myers was the moderator of the debate. John, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. Happy to do it.
Well, there's only one debate scheduled for the year, and a lot was riding on this for Kashkari.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and clearly it was very early in the season. This was a debate 2 months before Election Day. A lot of people have wondered why Jerry Brown won't do more. Clearly, you and I probably know why he won't do more, because he's 16 points ahead in the polls. He's got 10 times as much money or more than Neil Kashkari. He's going to go back under the radar, I think, for a while. So Kashkari had a lot riding on this, trying to kind of get himself on the same stage and make his case and take a few jabs. And, you know, I think he did most of those things.
I mean, we always talk about the importance of debates and how sometimes, you know, you go back to presidential history and presidential lore and how debates made a difference. But when you're down 16 points in the polls, it's hard for one debate, let alone a series of debates, to make much of a difference.
It is. I mean, you know, you and I know this so well. We watch these modern political debates. They are so much more theater than debate. A young man who called into our public affairs show the other day when I was on, and he's on a debate team for his high school, and talked about how this wasn't a debate. And I said, "You're right. It's not. It's an attack event where it's like a jab here and a jab there." But I mean, you know, it does give us a small sense of who they are. It does make them think on their feet a little bit. You know, and the other thing that I find interesting, too, is that Jerry Brown has debated probably more than any politician in California history. We know those famous debates when he ran for president. We know the one with Bill Clinton where they get, you know, started pointing their fingers at each other.
Right.
Brown knows this territory well. Neel Kashkari has never debated before. There was no formal debate in the June primary election. And so this was kind of his first time, and everybody wanted to see could he hold his own.
It seems like the issue that drew the most heat was over the quality of public education in the state. He is Kashkari.
This is one of the most important civil rights cases in years, not just in California, in the country. Nine kids sued Governor Brown and said that their civil rights, as guaranteed by the California Constitution, are being violated by our failing schools. You had a choice between fighting for the civil rights of poor kids and fighting for the union bosses who funded your campaigns. You sided with the union bosses. You should be ashamed of yourself, Governor. I'm going to fight for the kids. I want you to know that.
That makes no sense at all. That is so false.
It's absolutely true, Governor.
No, it's absolutely true. Gentlemen.
Do they know that they're getting no dessert if they keep fighting?
Yeah, I enforce that right afterwards. I put all the spoons and the plates and the pie away.
Don't make me stop this car right now.
And of course, you know, the whole tee off on this is you know, schools, yes, but more specifically, of course, this ruling, Vergara versus California, this closely watched court case out of Southern California about teacher tenure, and does teacher tenure at its worst impede the civil rights of students in low-income communities where they may have a bad teacher who can't be gotten rid of because of tenure? Jerry Brown, last week, the week before the debate, appealed that ruling to a higher court and had to try to defend it in this debate. And, of course, Kashkari really did almost, again, it's almost an homage to the Clinton-Brown debate, isn't it, Ken? You want to be ashamed of yourself? I think Bill Clinton said that to Jerry Brown.
That's exactly
one time,
right, so. when he was attacking his Bill Clinton's wife, exactly, back in 92. How would you sum up, though, Jerry Brown's record on public education in California?
Let's put it this way. If you look at 2011 to now, since the time he came back into office, the governor has done two things. One, he went to the voters to ask for a temporary tax increase that he promoted as helping schools. And it did help schools, but more specifically, the state budget in that 2012 timeframe actually had an automatic trigger in it that would have cut school funding if the voters had rejected those taxes. So in some way, he promoted himself as a man who was trying to help the schools have money in the middle of the state's budget problems. The second thing the governor did that Brown has done was to direct more tax dollars towards schools that serve low-income kids and children who are English language learners. And those are two of the more problematic, difficult parts of the California school experience. The governor trying to send more money to them. He and Kashkari both seem to believe that there need to be fewer strings from state government in Sacramento about how money is spent on schools. But Kashkari has many fewer strings than Jerry Brown would propose, basically saying every school, each individual neighborhood school would get a pot of money, spend it however you want to spend it. Much more freedom there than Brown and Democrats in the state legislature want to give. And I think that's a real, you know, contrast in the race.
And what do you make of the Kashkari argument that, I mean, forget the rhetoric, but that the governor is caring more about the unions than about the students?
Well, I think the basis for that is the fact that the state's teachers union, the California Teachers Association, which is really the most powerful political force in the state, they have been supporters of the governor. They supported his 2010 gubernatorial campaign when he came back into office. They supported that tax measure Proposition 30. And they win a lot of battles in state government. Having said that, Brown has an independent streak of ticking off even his supporters, and he hasn't done everything that the teachers have wanted him to do, including some of the funding issues that they've wanted over the last few years. So there's a, you know, as with so many things in politics, Ken, there's a nugget of truth there that kind of gets added into this much larger rhetorical boulder.
And while Kashkari was attacking Brown over the over education, Brown went on the offensive over Kashkari's role with Goldman Sachs. Here's Brown.
I mean, there's so many glib statements here that don't comport with reality. I don't know where to start. I feel like I'm getting a sales pitch from I don't know whom. Neil. Well, you learned your job well there, working at Goldman Sachs and all the rest of the people who wrecked the economy. And we had to bail them out, though. It's kind of like the arsonist putting out the fire. I really appreciate that. But let's get to the facts here. California is doing the best job putting Obamacare into practice.
You know that Jerry Brown hasn't lost his touch for little jabs as well.
Well, and certainly, too, you know, sitting there just a few feet from them in the television studio, let me set the stage for people. When Jerry Brown and Neel Kashkari walked in, the governor hardly even acknowledged that anyone else was in the studio, didn't look at Kashkari, just, you know, worked about his microphone on his lapel and his water straight and everything else. Kashkari actually was almost like, I don't want to call it starstruck because that sounds like he likes Jerry Brown. He clearly doesn't. But he was somewhat in awe of being in the room with him, I think, and had to go over and introduce himself to him. Brown didn't pay him a lot of attention in the beginning of the debate. As the debate went on, I'd say even 6-7 minutes into this hour-long debate, I could see Jerry Brown starting to get ticked off. And when he got ticked off, he got fired up about Kashkari's background, working on Wall Street, working for Goldman Sachs. You know, the TARP program has been controversial for a lot of reasons, but clearly there were a lot of connections between the investment banking world and the Department of Treasury. I mean, Neel Kashkari was an acolyte of Hank Paulson and was brought to Treasury by Hank Paulson. You know, they both were at Goldman. And so Brown had all that stuff, you know, in his back pocket and was ready to pull it out there. And I think you may hear that again on this campaign. I don't think you're going to see Jerry Brown engage a lot unless something goes wrong in this reelection campaign. But if he does, he's going to make it very much a, you know, the fat cats of Wall Street got something. And, you know, guys like Neel Kashkari played both ends of that game.
For a politician who's been around for 40 years, it's hard to say that a debate or 10 debates, as Kashkari would have liked, will make much of a difference. You're not going to learn much stuff about Jerry Brown. Did we learn anything new about Brown?
I think the one thing that I took from this this debate that I don't know if it's learning, but I think it is the motto of Jerry Brown going forward. And again, as a reminder to people listening, Brown's job approval numbers are in the mid to high 50s, which is pretty darn good for a governor of California.
For any politician, right?
Exactly. Much better than the president. I should mention the president is at his historic low in California now at about 45%. And that does have some Democrats worried about turnout come November. But that's another podcast, I guess, so as we'd say. But Brown, you know, has done pretty good at navigating the problems through California, at solving some of the most immediate problems, the state's budget problems and a few other things. He has a wide lead over Neel Kashkari. People don't know who Neel Kashkari is. A most recent public poll shows that almost half the voters don't even know who the guy is, don't have an opinion on him. And the one thing I did take away, though, when you get to about what we learn about Brown, is that Brown has slowed down so much from the politician he used to be. And I don't mean that in an age sense. I mean that in the sense that he's not in a hurry to make a mark. And most of what Brown has talked about in that California is on its way back, Brown believes it is a path that the state is on, and we need to keep on that path. People like Neel Kashkari and other Republican critics have said that Brown is ignoring all the things that still aren't fixed, poverty, unemployment in some parts of California. Brown sees it as a, you know, we're there, almost as the, I think as a presidential campaign said, you know, stay the course. And that's what Brown's message, I think, is going to be in this campaign. And if he wins, and most people think he wins, it would be an unprecedented fourth term as governor of California, longer than anyone in the history of the Golden State. And we'll see what he would do next.
John Myers is a senior editor of California Politics and Government at KQED in San Francisco. He was the moderator of last week's debate between Governor Jerry Brown and his Republican opponent, Neel Kashkari. John, it was great having you on the show again.
Always fun, Ken. Thanks a lot.
Lots of other political news this week. Tuesday was the last primary day of the 2014 cycle, with contests in Delaware, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and for state and local offices only, New York. The big headline of the day came out of the 6th Congressional District of Massachusetts. Nine-term Democrat John Tierney was beaten in the primary by Seth Moulton, an Iraq War veteran who used voter anger over Tierney's family ethics problems to propel him to victory.
Our win tonight says two things. First, that we are fed up with the gridlock in Washington. And second, that voters want to keep this seat blue.
Moulton now goes on to the general election, where he faces former State Senator Richard Desai, who is gay and who barely lost to Tierney 2 years ago. In TV news, NBC's Meet the Press got a new host this week. Chuck Todd replaced David Gregory, who has been blamed, fairly or not, for the revered Sunday program's decline in the ratings. Todd had the good fortune to get a pretty important guest in his first show, President Obama. The president had made news the day before by saying he would defer a decision as to what to do about immigration until after the election. And Todd wanted to know how much of a role politics played in that.
I want to make sure
the public's not behind you. You're not taking it. That sounds a little bit like that. You're concerned the public wouldn't support what you did.
What I'm saying is that I'm going to act because it's the right thing for the country. But it's going to be more sustainable and more effective if the public understands what the facts are on immigration, what we've done on unaccompanied children, and why it's necessary. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that the politics did shift midsummer because of that problem.
Right.
I want to spend some time, even as we're getting all our ducks in a row for the executive action, I also want to make sure that the public understands why we're doing this, right, why it's the right thing for the American people, why it's the right thing for the American economy.
President Obama addressed the nation Wednesday evening to discuss the challenges the U.S. faces in the Middle East with the Islamic State.
Tonight I call on Congress again to give us additional authorities and resources to train and equip these fighters. In the fight against ISIL, we cannot rely on an Assad regime that terrorizes its own people, a regime that will never regain the legitimacy it has lost. Instead, we must strengthen the opposition as the best counterweight to extremists like ISIL, while pursuing the political solution necessary to solve Syria's crisis once and for all.
There are a lot of reasons to be glued to the TV set on Saturday. For some of you, it might have been about college football. But let's be honest, some of the games were, as expected, complete blowouts. Number 2, Alabama trouncing Florida Atlantic, 41-0. Number 4, Oklahoma crushing Tulsa, 52-7. Well, the Senate race in Kansas was supposed to be a blowout as well, but it's no longer looking that way. And so the thing to watch on TV Saturday was the debate between the three-term Republican Senator, Pat Roberts, and the suddenly surging Greg Orman, his independent challenger. Kansas Senate races are usually not on anyone's watch list. Correction. They're never on anyone's watch list. But something seems to be happening. Steve Kraske is the host of KCUR's Up to Date and a columnist for the Kansas City Star. Steve, welcome back to the show and help me out here. What's going on? What's the matter with Kansas?
Boy, what is going on out here, Ken? No one would have expected a year ago that Governor Sam Brownback, the incumbent, and incumbent Senator Pat Roberts, both Republicans in the reddest of red states in America, would both be fighting for their political lives. But that's exactly what's going on out here. I guess right now we're talking about the Senate race with Pat Roberts, and according to the latest polls, Roberts trails his independent challenger, Greg Orman, by 10 points, Ken, 43-33%. No one expected this. No one saw this coming. But Roberts seems to be catching a break, I should say, based on developments in a very chaotic week in Kansas politics last week. It appears that the Democrat, Chad Taylor, who has withdrawn from the race, it appears that his name is going to remain on the ballot. And if that happens, you'll have three names on the ballot. And the thinking out here is that will help Pat Roberts, who has his Republican base to sort of fall back on. That'll help him get across the finish line. Well, could rule, it could weigh in here and take the name off, and that would boost the prospects of the independent Greg Orman.
Well, yeah, let's not even go that far. Let's go back to the beginning. Roberts, we all thought, was completely safe, as every Kansas senator seems to be safe. And then we found out that he no longer owned a home in the state. And we saw what that did to Dick Lugar in 2012. It was hurting Pat Roberts in 2014.
You know, absolutely. That became a huge issue in the primary campaign with Roberts, challenger, just pounding on that point over and over and over again in TV ads. That notion that Roberts may not be a full-time resident of Kansas has really permeated the state now. People get it. And that is going to hurt Pat Roberts going forward into this general election.
Because I was going to say, I mean, Milton Wolf was Pat Roberts' Republican challenger in the primary, and he was a flawed candidate. I mean, he had his own problems, and yet he got 41% of the vote in the primary. That's pretty sizable, considering the fact that he was not the strongest candidate to put up against him.
You know, Ken, you're absolutely right. And Milton Wolf ran basically a one-issue campaign. And that one issue was these questions about Senator Pat Roberts' residency or non-residency in Kansas. And Wolf raised, you know, kept pounding on it throughout the primary. And I think that really helped him. That very simple idea of, is your incumbent senator still one of you or is he a Washington guy? I think that very simple idea really got through to a lot of voters. And it hurt Pat Roberts in that primary.
And then you have the Democratic candidate you mentioned, Chad Taylor. There were Democrats who came to him around the country and said, wait a second, this Greg Orman independent candidate is starting to take off. If you stay in the race, Chad Taylor, you split the opposition to Roberts, get out. And he said, okay, I'm getting out.
You said that very well. And I think the reason that Chad Taylor ultimately backed away, Ken, he had no money. I mean, he had maybe $1,000, $1,500 in the bank, no ability to sort of grow his margins in the state. And he's running at a time when there's this very intense governor's race going on that we alluded to a little while ago with a Democrat named Paul Davis as the nominee there. Paul Davis is scooping up, vacuuming up every available dollar that might go to a Democratic Senate candidate out in Kansas. All that money's going to the governor's race right now. So Chad Taylor really had nowhere to go. You have Greg Orman in the race, who's a successful businessman. He can self-fund to some extent. So the choice, even among Democrats, seemed to be, hey, let's go with Greg Orman. We'd have a better chance that way. Orman, we believe he's a Democrat. He began a race for the U.S. Senate 6 years ago, announcing as a Democrat. Let's put our chips in that basket and see what happens.
Now, Orman is telling voters that he really is not a Democrat. He's not a Republican. He's really, truly an independent, tired of both parties, disgusted with both parties. And he says, as of now, he's not sure what party he would vote with and vote to organize with should he win.
It's a big issue out here, and it came up in a debate on Saturday at the state fair, Ken, where Pat Roberts challenged Greg Orman, wanted to know, hey, you know, which party would you caucus with? And Orman never answered the question. And it really does lead to this tricky position that an independent candidate would find him or herself, you know, out in a state like Kansas. People don't really know what you stand for when you don't have the backdrop of one of our major parties behind you to sort of give you an ideological framework upon which to base a campaign. People don't know very much about Greg Orman out here. The state fair debate on Saturday helped answer some of those questions, but people are still scratching their heads to some extent out here in Kansas.
And one thing I thought was kind of interesting with Pat Roberts' tactics or technique, he spent less time talking about Greg Orman and more talking about Harry Reid.
We must stop the Obama agenda. But before we can do that, we have to break Harry Reid's stranglehold on the Senate. The House has passed over 350 bills, all of which are stuck in the Senate, where now good legislation goes to die. The choice is clear. I am the only candidate on this stage that will vote to put Harry Reid out to pasture and break the gridlock.
I remember when Democrats loved to run against Newt Gingrich and Republicans loved to run against Nancy Pelosi, but is Harry Reid a household name in Kansas? And whose household?
Well, if he wasn't before Saturday, Ken, he certainly is now, because Pat Roberts brought up Harry Reid's name, it seemed like every 45 seconds or so. It became kind of a comic refrain as the debate went along. Orman supporters jeering every time Roberts would mention Harry Reid's name as this debate progressed through the hour there. And, you know, again, you know, Roberts is smart here. You have a candidate, his opponent, Greg Orman, not well-defined. People don't know who he is. Roberts is trying to do that job for Orman by stamping him clearly as a Democrat in this very Republican state as a way to sort of undermine Greg Orman's campaign.
Earlier, I talked about Dick Lugar of Indiana, who lost his primary in 2012, who basically didn't have a residence when he came back home to Indiana. And by the time Lugar realized what was happening to him, it was too late. Does Roberts have time to regroup?
You know, I think he does. And I wrote in the paper on Sunday, Ken, that I thought Roberts used the debate to sort of stabilize his campaign. He's buoyed by this notion out here now that on the ballot, there'll be three names, at least as the way things stand today. And that helps his campaign. And, you know, I think he's you know, trying to throw some red meat out to the supporters, his supporters and Republicans on Saturday, trying to re-energize a base that's been somewhat deflated, you know, by the difficult prospects of the Republican governor and the Republican incumbent senator out here, trying to rejuvenate things. And I thought he was pretty effective at it, very much raising questions about Greg Orman. Who are you? What do you stand for? Which party would you caucus with? And only some of those questions were answered by Orman on Saturday.
One of the things that, and you mentioned this on the show a couple of months ago, one of the things that people notice about Pat Roberts is that once upon a time, or you know, at some point in his career, Pat Roberts was seen as a Dole Kassebaum kind of Republican, a conservative, yes, but a moderate conservative. As the party has moved further to the right over the last couple of years, Pat Roberts has moved with it.
Absolutely no question about it, Ken. He's been very astute about that, moving with the times, adjusting his votes in the last two or three years. He ranks now as one of the most conservative senators in the country based on those National Journal rankings that come out every year. So he has moved rightward. Almost everyone seems to agree with that. And I think if he turns out to win this campaign, that'll have proven to be a very adroit move, at least politically, to help him get reelected.
You mentioned that Pat Roberts got his point across that he wanted to tie Orman with Harry Reid and the Democrats like this. As far as Orman goes, I mean, his theme is Washington is broken, Roberts is part of the problem. Here he is at the debate.
Kansans really do believe Washington is broken. They really do believe we're sending the worst of both parties, not just Republicans, not just Democrats, but both parties to Washington. And that if we want to solve our problems as a nation, we're going to have to get back into the serious business of problem solving instead of simply positioning to get reelected.
You know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, no matter where you are in the country, there is this anti-Washington, Washington is broken sense out there.
And Greg Orman's call here to sort of begin to solve problems and not bicker and not be so partisan, you know, that message may wind up resonating very well out here. The anti-Washington sentiment that you hear across the country, very much evident in Kansas as well. You know, it strikes me as something of a more difficult argument to make because in doing so, Orman has to come off as sounding very reasonable, almost polite. He can't, you know, be knocking Pat Roberts and tearing him down in the manner of Washington because he wants to be something different. So voters are going to have to listen to him, hear his very reasonable, well-calibrated argument, and they might end up buying it here. But it's something different. Voters are used to hearing red meat and people tearing each other down. It's going to be very interesting to see how voters respond to what Orman has to say in a style that's different than voters are used to out here.
You've been covering Kansas politics since Alf Landon was governor. Did you?
Thanks a lot.
Did you ever in your wildest dreams expect a Republican senator and a Republican governor in the same year, in a year especially when the Democratic president is so unpopular, did you ever expect two Republicans like that to be in trouble for reelection?
You know, absolutely not, Ken. I'm a smart guy, but I'm not that smart. Absolutely breathtaking developments out here to have both Governor Brownback, Senator Roberts, both fighting for their lives here in the same year. And as you point out, in a year when the president, the Democratic president, is relatively unpopular, this is really new ground out here, and everyone's taken aback by it, Ken.
Steve Kresge is a columnist for the Kansas City Star and the host of KCUR's Up to Date. You can follow him on Twitter at Steve Kresge. That's K-R-A-S-K-E. And you could hear Up to Date weekdays at 11 a.m. on KCUR. Steve, thanks a lot for being on the show again.
Ken, I'm always happy to do it.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. That's me, and this is that. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, we know that in 1964, Henry Cabot Lodge...
And Henry Cabot Lodge.
Yes, that Henry Cabot Lodge. Henry Cabot Lodge became the first person to win the New Hampshire presidential primary as a write-in candidate. Who was the second to accomplish that? And the answer is Lyndon Johnson. 4 years later, in 1968, President Johnson's name was not on the ballot, but he got more votes as a write-in candidate than did Eugene McCarthy, whose name was on the ballot. LBJ won the primary, but less than 3 weeks later, he shocked the world by announcing he would not run again.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
And Joel Shapiro of Bound Brook, New Jersey, shocked the world as well. He's this week's randomly selected winner. He gets the coveted political junkie button. And last week's scuttlebutt puzzle? There were two buttons in the top row, an I Miss Ike and Truman button, meant to be a criticism of President Kennedy, and a Miss Me Yet button for former Florida Governor Claude Kirk. Then a Dowd for Congress button from New Jersey, which was followed by a Burn Baby Burn button showing the U.S. flag on fire. If you have a Miss Ike and a Miss Me Yet button on the same line, that gives you Mrs. So it's Mrs. Dowdfire.
What do you mean you do voices?
Well, I do voices.
Yes!
We've come to this planet looking for intelligent life. Oops, we made a mistake.
We're happy to be in America. Don't ask for a green card.
I want you in the worst way.
Well, this is certainly a rough meeting, and it's not going very well for me, I'll tell you that. Hey, boss, give it a chance. She's going to loosen up any moment.
Look at me right now, Moneypenny. I want to undo that bow and get to know you.
I'm crazy to make a deal with you!
Nancy and I are still looking for the other half of my head.
Yes, idiot! You're doing it! I'm sitting on a gold mine!
Don't make me smack you, sweetheart. I'll do it.
Figaro!
Mr. Hillard, do you consider yourself humorous?
I used to.
Another tribute to the late Robin Williams. And the scuttlebutt winner is Leonard Williams of Fort Wayne, Indiana. No relation, but undoubtedly pretty clever as well. Congrats, Leonard. And this week, I've been challenged to a trivia question. Let's take a listen to this message from our Google voicemail inbox.
Hey, Ken, this is Michael Brooks in Alabaster, Alabama. We're a suburb of Birmingham. I have a trivia for you. Do you know the only U.S. president and spouse who attended the same high school? I enjoy the podcast, listen to it every week, and appreciate your insights and your good humor.
I think I know the answer, but how about you? Do you know it? If you think you do, leave a message on our Political Junkie phone line at 316-536-9646. That's 316-536-9646. Here's the question again. Who are the only American president and spouse who attended the same high school? 316-536-9646. Thanks for the question, Michael. The first correct answer gets played on the air next week. If there are no correct answers, then I will reveal the answer and I will get the coveted political junkie button. I'm sorry, but that's how it works here. Don't forget to visit our website, which is filled with trivia questions and scuttlebutt puzzles and all that fun stuff. That's krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll be right back. It's time for This Week in Political History. Actually, for residents of New Orleans, it was more than a week. The destruction left behind by Hurricane Katrina in August and September of 2005 was unfathomable. More than 1,800 deaths, property losses at $108 billion. The city still hasn't fully recovered 9 years later. And the political destruction, while hardly on the same level, and really not deserving to be in the same sentence, was immense too. It was 9 years ago this week when Michael Brown resigned as head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. This is the same Michael Brown whom President Bush lauded in the early days of Hurricane Katrina.
Again, I want to thank you all and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
But then, when it became apparent that the federal government's preparation and response wasn't good enough, Brown became a political liability and he announced he would leave. It wasn't only President Bush who suffered politically. The governor, Kathleen Blanco, was also widely criticized for her slow response to the disaster. She was accused of failing to effectively help people trying to evacuate from New Orleans. She bowed to the inevitable and announced in 2007 that she would not seek a second term.
While so many still suffer, I am choosing to do what I believe is best for my state. I will focus my time and my energy for the next 9 months on the people's work, not on politics. After much thought and prayer, I have decided that I will not seek re-election as your governor. There is nothing more important to Louisiana's future than a strong recovery, free from politics.
Tyler Bridges is a freelance journalist based in New Orleans. Until recently, he covered Louisiana politics and public policy for The Lens. And before that, he was a longtime political reporter at the Miami Herald and the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He's the author of The Rise of David Duke and Bad Bet on the Bayou, The Rise of Gambling in Louisiana and the Fall of Governor Edwin Edwards. Tyler, welcome to The Political Junkie. And you know New Orleans and its people and politics like no one else. Try to explain, if you can, what the city was like before and after Katrina.
I would say before Katrina, this was a city where you could have a good time, but it was a city where not a lot was moving forward. I always remember the statistic that at the time of the Civil War, New Orleans was the fourth biggest city in terms of population in the country. And before Katrina, it was down to about 35. Just really not a lot of energy. And for all the terrible things that happened during Katrina, you know, the lives lost, there's actually some positive things maybe that have come out of Katrina. That, you know, there's a clear feeling that the city is rebounding, that things are getting better, that property values are rising, that people are investing here, that, you know, there's work, people like the mayor. So, you know, it looks like some positive things have come out of a terrible disaster.
Well, there may be some positive things going on now, you know, 9 years later. But at the time, I mean, it was just beyond comprehension. It was so horrific. And there was so much blame going around for what happened in the aftermath. So let's start with President Bush. The picture that sticks in my head is the one of him looking outside of the window of Air Force One as it flew over New Orleans in the early days of the calamity.
Yeah, and I think that became an iconic image. And I think a lot of people would say today that was one of the things that sowed the seeds of his decline and public approval, the sense that this guy just didn't care when there was suffering on the ground. You know, the comment that he made about Brownie when the federal government had clearly failed and again, more than 1,000 people died. It was a sense that this president was out of touch.
You mentioned that Katrina seemed to be the beginning of the decline of the Bush presidency. I think maybe even more so than Iraq. The verdict on him was he was insensitive to what was going on the ground. As you say, looking out the window in Air Force One, was that the feeling down on the ground that he just was too distant and too far away to realize the pain and suffering?
Yeah, you know, it was just an absolute calamity here in New Orleans. And the response of the federal government was just so woefully inadequate. Meanwhile, people were dying in their attics, and it's just a, you know, terrible tragedy. And survivors were having to wait days for the federal government, which was really the only institution that could help people. You know, the scenes at the Louisiana Superdome. And President Bush, I think, rightly paid a political cost for it.
You mentioned that, that of course, Bush got the blame and Governor Blanco got blame and Mayor Ray Nagin, in some respects, got blame, too. They, I mean, for having failed to force mandatory evacuations from the city as the storm was approaching. Let's just talk about their roles before, during, and after Katrina. Let's start with Kathleen Blanco. Basically, her political future became untenable.
Yeah, and again, remember, you know, she was a popular governor, a woman, the first female governor in the state's history, Democrat, pro-life, very handy with a gun, but she appeared very, very weak, particularly on TV in the immediate aftermath of the Katrina. She didn't sort of project strength. You know, her staff probably made a mistake of putting her on TV when she was, you know, she had barely slept the night before. Her public approval just plummeted. And I think people have done research since then and said that she did a lot of good things, but it was just a sense that she was overwhelmed, that the state government hadn't taken the preparations necessary for a hurricane of this level.
This is one of those bipartisan disasters in that a Republican president, a Democratic governor, and I guess a nominally Democratic mayor all suffered politically because of what happened and their response to it.
Yeah, and I'll point out as well, Ken, that the Democratic president of Jefferson Parish, which actually has a bigger population than New Orleans, the two parishes are next to each other, his political career was ended by Katrina as well because he was seen as not having taken the proper preparations for Katrina. And Aaron Broussard also, after the several years later, was caught in a corruption scandal. He's in prison, too.
I never knew there was corruption in Louisiana.
Well, I know it's a surprise for you, but
Tyler Bridges is a longtime New Orleans political journalist. He can be found on Twitter at TEG Bridges. Tyler, thanks a lot for being on the show.
My pleasure, Ken.
In his farewell news conference, President Bush acknowledged the cloud Katrina had over his administration.
I thought long and hard about Katrina. You know, could I have done something differently? Like land Air Force One, either New Orleans or Baton Rouge? The problem with that is that law enforcement would have been pulled away from the mission. And then your questions, I suspect, would have been, how could you possibly have flown Air Force One into Baton Rouge and police officers that were needed to expedite traffic out of New Orleans were taken off the task to look after you?
It was this week in 2005 that Michael Brown, then the director of FEMA, resigned from his position. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. Virginia, when we last left you, Bob was worrying what to do. His wife Maureen was mean. She was cruel to her staff. And worse, she was flirting with the evil businessman Johnny. She was getting designer clothes and handbags and all that stuff from him. All Bob got was a Rolex watch, oh, maybe some airplane trips. Bob gave Maureen his heart, but she turned distant. He wanted to be in love, not watch movies about love. What to do? Does he leave her? Does he throw her under the bus? Michael Pope is a reporter for WAMU who sat through the entire trial and watched as McDonald and his wife were convicted on almost all the corruption counts. Michael, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
As the Commonwealth turns, these are the days of our lives.
Exactly. I mean, I was being a little silly in my introduction, but these are serious corruption charges against someone who was not only a rising star in the Republican Party, he was a potential running mate to Mitt Romney, even a possible presidential candidate himself. But as you say, this felt like a soap opera from day one.
This is a stunning fall from grace for a guy who was widely considered to be, as you said, a rising star in the Republican Party.
Tell me exactly what they were charged with and what they were convicted of.
There was a 14-count indictment, and the prosecutors got almost a sweep. They got basically almost everything they were looking for, with the exception of two counts, count 12 and count 13, which were essentially bank fraud charges. two different loans from this guy, Johnny Williams, the former executive of Star Scientific. It's really interesting here because the prosecutors apparently gave Bob McDonnell an opportunity to plead guilty to bank fraud, and as a result of that, all the other charges would go away and his wife would not be charged at all. Bob McDonnell said, no, I'm not guilty of bank fraud. I'll see you in court. And so now we have the situation where he has been found guilty on 11 corruption charges. His wife has been found guilty on 9 corruption charges. They face decades in prison. And you have to wonder if this decision to not take the plea deal was a colossal mistake.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of defense strategy that sound either like a mistake or misguided on the McDonald's point. Talk about the defense strategy Bob McDonald used regarding his wife.
It's important to remember that there are actually two different defense strategies because there are two different defendants. Bob McDonald was one of the defendants, and his strategy all along was that he did nothing more than promote a Virginia business, which all governors should be doing, and that he took no official action to help Johnny Williams. In fact, he said a number of times on the stand, the only action that he ever took to help Johnny Williams was a personal call to his father on his birthday. Now, jurors completely disagreed with that. They felt like he took official government actions to schedule meetings and to press Virginia scientists to conduct studies of this product, Anatoblock. The governor's strategy was also that he would be able to testify in his own behalf, talking about, you know, why he took the actions that he did and sort of swatting down the prosecutor's charges one by one, which he attempted to do. As it turns out, that was a calculation that misfired because jurors did not believe the governor's testimony. Maureen McDonald's defense was different, and she did not testify. Her defense and her lawyers laid out what has become known as the crush defense, that Maureen McDonald had a crush on Johnny Williams, that the McDonald marriage was crumbling. This is where the soap opera elements come in. Cue the soap opera music here. That she was infatuated with him and that he took advantage of her deteriorating marriage to get closer to her, to get closer to the McDonald's, and to use them for his own benefit. And so, again, that is a calculation that, in retrospect, failed because jurors were not buying the crush defense either.
Were you in the courtroom when the verdict was reached?
I was in the courthouse. Actually, I was in what they call the overflow room, which is another courtroom which had a video feed and an audio feed, mainly because we needed to get the news out to folks, and that was the best way to do it because the courtroom itself was locked. But I could hear through the audio of the room that I was in of the McDonald relatives weeping. I mean, it was really a very dramatic scene here as guilty verdict after guilty verdict was rendered from this jury. I had this list that was a sort of a checklist that, you know, had count one, Bob McDonald guilty, count one, Maureen McDonald guilty. So I was sort of checking off the guilties on my checklist. And as this thing was going on, it was, you know, guilty, 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 guilty. And you could hear audible sobbing from the McDonald relatives as this was going on. This was a very big deal for a family that believed that they had done nothing wrong. And it was an extremely emotional event, as you might imagine.
Well, you know, to many people, it seemed like a pretty cut and dry case by the prosecutors. And yet, I mean, the reason I asked you if you were in the courtroom, because it sounded like everybody I spoke to, they seemed shocked, like there was a collective gasp when the verdict was read. Like we know, they may be guilty, but my goodness, we never expected a verdict like this.
Well, I tell you, I think a lot of the reaction has been from people who are in the political system who say things like, what the McDonald's have done happens literally every day in American politics. And you have to now wonder about the elected official who's looking at himself or herself in the mirror and asking if they should go on this golf trip that's paid for by the lobbyist, if they should get on the corporate jet that's paid for by the big-time political donor, if they should have the event at the governor's mansion that's sponsored by so-and-so corporation, you know, you really have to think that these guilty verdicts in this case have really reshuffled the deck and made elected officials think differently about their behavior and what kinds of activity they should be engaging in.
Well, Virginia has a reputation for not having, well, I should say Virginia has a reputation for having a pretty lax set of ethics rules. I mean, ethics laws. Is there any discussion of changes?
Well, yes and no. So the Virginia has a reputation of having lax ethical rules. That's, you're entirely right about that. And in terms of receiving gifts and receiving campaign contributions and receiving golf trips and receiving high top shelf cognac and all those things, all of that's legal. And there has been some discussion in the Virginia General Assembly about changing some of the disclosure laws. It's also important to point out that the federal prosecutors were not at all concerned about what the Virginia law was, because they were not prosecuting them on Virginia law. They were prosecuting them on federal law. And so one of the interesting issues in this whole case has been the paradox that you can be totally in the right and following Virginia law to the letter, but also be guilty of federal corruption charges.
What kind of a sentence are they expected to get, and when will we know that?
So January is the sentencing date, and you can just imagine the holiday season that's upcoming here on the horizon for the McDonald family sitting around the Christmas table talking about these guilty verdicts in the case. So January is the sentencing. They are both facing decades in prison, like to the tune of about 30 years max in prison. But it's also important to point out that white-collar criminals do not tend to receive the maximum. And it's Judge James Spencer gets to make the call here, unlike the Virginia court system where the jurors get to make the sentence. In the federal system, even in Virginia, the judge, in this case, Judge James Spencer, gets to make the call on what the sentencing is. So we're expecting that to happen in January.
Michael Pope covers Northern Virginia and soap operas for WAMU. He can be found on Twitter at Michael Lee Pope. Michael, thanks for being on the show, and we'll see you at Kim Kardashian's divorce hearing. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Want to catch the podcast? You can subscribe on iTunes, add us to your Stitcher playlist, and track us down on TuneIn Radio. The Political Junkie is also on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttle button puzzles, you can visit us on the web at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.